Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. In this edition, we talk about the art instinct, beauty, pleasure, and human evolution, based on a book with our guest, Dennis Dutton. As much as fighting wild animals or finding suitable environments, our ancient ancestors faced social forces and family conflicts that became a part of evolved life. Both of these force fields, acting in concert, eventually produced the intensely social, robust, lovemaking, murderous, convivial, organizing, technology-using, show-off, squabbling, game-playing, friendly, status-seeking, upright walking, lying, omnivorous, knowledge-seeking, arguing, clubbing, language-using, conspicuously wasteful, versatile species of primate that we became. And along the way, in developing all this, the arts were born. I spoke with Dennis Dutton from his home in Christchurch, New Zealand, on July 17, 2009, and began our conversation by asking him to further explain the birth of the arts. Dennis Dutton, welcome to Radio Curious.
Delighted to be here, Barry.
And you're a long way from our studios in Ukiah, California, being in Christchurch, New Zealand.
That's right, way down here. But as a California native, it doesn't seem that far to me.
So where I'd like to begin this afternoon is your explanation of where the arts were born.
Well, I think the arts are a very late development in human evolution. And, of course, they're a late development in human culture and have changed through human culture. But the thesis of the art instinct is that underlying all these multifarious cultural forms, all these differences that we have in the arts, whether we're talking about painting or poetry or music or dance, that underlying them are certain basic evolutionary capacities and impulses and desires. And that these capacities and impulses had evolutionary adaptive value in the Pleistocene, in the 1.6 million years when we became humans. We went through Homo erectus and came out as Homo sapiens at the other end. And these impulses are what my book is about. My book doesn't deny that there isn't a huge cultural component in the arts. We all know that. We know arts are different in different cultures. We know that arts change culturally through time. But underlying these things are basic, universal, adaptive values.
Let's talk about what those universal adaptive values are so that we have a platform from where we can proceed.
Well, I think the most important of all of them is the notion of what you might call decoupled imagination. The idea that human beings can think imaginatively about whole scenarios, stories, threats, imagination of a sexual nature, or about adventures that one might have, or about family conflicts. To be able to think imaginatively about whole worlds, which is, in fact, the world of storytelling, had a huge adaptive advantage for our early ancestors. A Darwinian is able to construct a picture of early human history, of human prehistory, in terms of the adaptive value of imagination and storytelling. This went along with, of course, the evolution of language, the ability simply to describe the world. From there, we jump off to the ability to describe imaginative worlds. And this would have had tremendous survival value. If you could imagine two tribes, one of which can barely use language to describe present states of affairs, of what's going on right now, but the other tribe can use language to talk about the distant past, about possibilities for the future, about what's going on over in the other mountain, and then can use that imaginative ability in this decoupled from ordinary reality to think in terms of myths, of imaginary stories, of what it would be like to encounter a lion on a hunt or whatever it might be, that would have terrific survival value in the Pleistocene. I think that's the beginning of the arts.
Well, let's then define the arts.
The arts are a concatenation of a lot of things. I'm an academic philosopher who's done aesthetics for all of his career. And I think one of the problems that aesthetics has had is that everybody seems to glom on to their favorite aspect of the arts and see the arts in terms of that one aspect. So you have people like the modern aesthetician Clive Bell, who loved modernist painting and wanted to explain it in terms of form. You have people like Tolstoy saying that, well, really it's tying people together and emotional involvement with other people, which is the essence of the arts. You have all of these different views of the arts, but you don't have them in terms of the rather messy and incomplete and fuzzy-edged nature of the thing itself. That's why the third chapter of my book, What is Art, actually goes through 12 criteria for what art is, you know, and it includes things like novelty and creativity, the fact that we like arts that represent the world, that actually give us a picture of the world in words or in poetry or in stories or in paintings or in acting out or in dance, special focus, the notion that we like the arts to somehow be a special focus of attention, that we like them to be expressive of the individuality of the artist, that the arts are sort of coextensive with emotional saturation. Works of art are involved intrinsically with emotion, that they involve intellectual challenges. But again, above all, it seems to me, they involve some kind of imaginative experience. Works of art don't happen in the real world. Works of art are make-believe worlds, and I mean the make-believe world of a Beethoven symphony, the make-believe world of Homer's Iliad or the Odyssey, the make-believe world of any movie you see on any weekend. Works of art happen in the theater of the mind. And for us as a species to have developed this ability to think in terms of imagination, to think in terms of the theater of the mind, was a huge advance with survival advantage in the Pleistocene.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the theater of the mind in cross-cultural differences. Assuming that the characters in the mind's theater are based on our initial experiences, something that we can recall and relate to, and in each family they're different, and in each culture they're more different.
Well, yes and no. Sure, there are differences. But the nuclear family of a father and a mother who care for children is not just a local California invention. It rather goes back through the whole of history and prehistory. Yes, of course, there are all sorts of differences on the edges, but there's an awful lot that people have in common in terms of their emotional life, in terms of their social relations, in terms of how they govern themselves, how hierarchies are formed in hunter-gatherer groups or in modern democratic societies, mass societies. There's an awful lot that people have in common. And works of art tend to concentrate on the universalities that underlie these things. Of course, culture changes things. Culture modulates and modifies. But underneath it all, you will find, for example, that Aristotle said that really all great drama involves relations between people, which should be relations of amity or of love, where these things are disrupted and people end up, for example, hating each other. What Aristotle said was that what's interesting is not a brother who loves his brother, but two brothers who should love each other, but who hate each other or fight over a woman. Something like this. And indeed, if you look at Greek tragedy, you find these themes echoed over and over again. You find them in Chinese literature, and you find them in every soap opera that's going on every television screen as we speak across the earth. Television screens are showing soap operas, and they are these same themes. And they're going on in China, they're going on in India, they're going on in Brazil. We've got to understand what the basic elements are that create these similarities and not be just simply dazzled by all of the cultural variations.
Well, then, can you help us understand what those basic similarities are?
Well, the basic similarities are, well, I mean, for example, many of the things I've discussed in the chapter on human nature. If you just look at human beings, they have lots of things which are inherited, as it were, adaptive Darwinian characteristics and intuitive physics, our sense of biology, our interest in plants and animals, the way in which we have a personal psychology, in which we see our own minds in one way and entertain beliefs and intentions and understand other people in a way that they help us to understand ourselves and we understand ourselves and apply that to other people. A tendency toward body adornment with paint, hairstyling, an intuitive sense of numbers, understood exactly for small numbers and extending into approximations for large numbers. This is the same across the world. Feelings for probability, an ability to read facial expressions. Facial expressions are a very interesting area. There's a man in San Francisco named Paul Ekman who has spent his career working on facial expressions worldwide, and they are remarkably similar in the way that we can read them across cultures. A precise ability to throw objects, for example, our interest in pitched sounds, in music. These are universal human characteristics, and some of them are at the basis of the arts.
In expressing the arts through language, as opposed to through pictures, we should look at the distinct functions, as you describe them, of language in human social life.
Language, again, I stress that often theorists with the best intentions in the world will describe the arts or complicated phenomena such as language in terms of one particular characteristic and sort of generalize from that one aspect and ignore other aspects. I mean, I think language is very interesting in this way because if you ask most people, including many academics, what is the function of language, they'll say communication. Yes, it is in part factual communication. But there's more communicated in language than is simply in the language itself. For example, if I am describing to you, telling you a story, an anecdote, something that happened on a camping trip last weekend, and I sort of give a narrative which might have a little bit of suspense in it or keep you hanging at one point and then some kind of resolution or surprise that happens through the story. Of course, you're listening in terms of what I'm communicating in terms of factual content. But there are other things you're listening to as well. And you're listening to this, I hold in the book, you're listening to this whether you want to or not. You're listening to the imagination that I'm showing in my word choice, in my ability to construct a story which makes sense, in my ability to express what's relevant to the story and to ignore what's irrelevant. And you're looking for some kind of competence or, you know, at the high-end genius in my ability to tell the story, tell the anecdote, and make it as entertaining as I can, which, of course, is part of what I'm doing in the way I've described this particular. This is not like a police report that I'm describing. I'm describing, you know, talking to somebody next to a water cooler or across a dinner table. Well, what this means is that language is more than simply directly factually communicative. It's a fitness indicator. And that is to say, it involves what Darwin would have understood as something that has its genesis in sexual selection. When you use language and you use it well, you're in a sense showing how intelligent, how competent, how capable you are as a person. We judge people all the time in terms of their language use. When they misuse, you know, verb, subject-verb agreement, or when they use the wrong word, it's a subject of mirth or embarrassment. I mean, think of all those restoration comedies with people who misuse language, or Dogberry, the character in Shakespeare, the police constable who's trying to talk like a lawyer and make such a hash of it. I mean, the misuse of language is actually something that we are programmed innately, that is to say, we are genetically predisposed to notice. And the reason is because language is a competence marker. We love relevant, beautiful, elegant flourishes in language. We love to hear exactly the right words used. This is part of the arts. It's part of poetic use of language, but it's part of just general intelligent use of language. And this is explained in Darwinian terms, in terms of sexual selection. Darwin came up with this theory of natural selection, which explains, you know, the pancreas and how the eye is formed, the liver and so forth, how we evolved as organic bodies that have certain kinds of organic structures. It also applies, natural selection also applies to many kinds of behavioral characteristics, why we're afraid of snakes, why the smell of rotting meat is such a turnoff and such a detestable smell to us. But there was another whole aspect of the organic world that many people noticed and that Darwin noticed, which is not explained by natural selection. And the primary example of that is the peacock's tail. The peacock grows this huge, beautiful tail with all of these eye spots on it. It's symmetrical. The peacock can fan it out and show it to the world in all its glory, but it doesn't have any value in natural selection. In fact, it makes peacocks more prone to predation by tigers in Southeast Asia than they otherwise would be. They shouldn't be growing that big tail. So that's a curiosity. It was for Darwin. Why do birds have these incredible colorations? Why do peacocks have these big tails? And he explained it in a way that is accepted universally as a matter of sexual selections. Peacocks grow those big tails because peahens choose to mate with peacocks who have the biggest tails.
Do we know why that is?
Yeah, evolution is producing something here, which is, as it were, some kind of gaudy, opulent, show-off display. Now, I think that kind of show-off display is also implicated deeply in the human personality. Much of what we do is not simply practical communication. It is positioning ourselves in relation to each other, men in relation to women, women in relation to men in relation to other men, women in relation to other women, and so on. In other words, we're presenting ourselves in ways which make us interesting and attractive, which might give us power or interest to other human beings. And this kind of psychology is involved with the arts and the genesis of the arts. It gives us our interest, for example, in skill displays. One of the things which I didn't mention in the characteristics of the arts is that the arts are involved in virtuoso skill displays. We love to see a great pianist simply, you know, tear up a keyboard with huge accuracy in playing a very hard piece of music. We love virtuoso displays in dance, in the use of language, simply that a poet. I mean, the virtuoso displays of a writer such as Jane Austen, who with huge elegance and wit can take us deeply into other human minds, imaginary human minds. So we love skill displays. Why do we love skill displays? We love skill displays because I think they are connected with sexual selection. We were in the Pleistocene. It wasn't simply survival of the fittest in the sense of survival of the brawniest or the strongest. It was survival of the wittiest, of the most intelligent, of the most competent. That's how we became the human beings that we are, and that's how the arts were born along with us in human prehistory.
This edition of Radio Curious, we are talking with Dennis Dutton about his book, The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. I'm Barry Vogel. Dennis, how do we take this knowledge and use it in our everyday lives?
Well, one of the things that is really important about this is that if you do understand the evolved characteristics of the human personality and the arts, you're less likely to come up with, how shall I put it, vapid or one-dimensional interpretations of the arts in terms of what our current preoccupations are. For example, if you go to, you know, around universities today, you'll find in graduate seminars people seem obsessed with politics. That is to say, they look at the history of English literature and they say, oh, what does this have to do with colonialism? Or what does it have to do with slavery? Or what does it have to do with the oppression of third world peoples? Everything is turned into politics. What an evolutionary approach to the arts does is not to deny the politics, but to say, hey, there's so much more going on in the arts. For example, there's pleasure. People get intense pleasure from the arts. This is hardly ever discussed, it seems to me, in universities. Evolution is about pleasure. Evolution is about universality. Evolution is about the way the arts spontaneously arise in every culture. So I think one of the most important things that we get out of this is that it takes us back to a basic, well-rounded view of what the arts are and what they mean to us in our lives, and don't reduce everything to some kind of academic fad or fashion. You know, whatever's going on this year is what we must discuss. We've got to look at the ancient sources of the arts, and we can better understand how they make sense to us today. Why we're driven to go to movies, why we love great concerts, you know, why listening to music or watching great films or great drama or reading the best novels, why these things so appeal to us. Seems to me we've got to get back to those questions and get away from these sort of jargon-ridden, you know, ideological academic fashions which have deadened the approach to the arts in the last 40 years.
So let's then talk about your website, artsandlettersdaily.com. How would you characterize the focus of what you put on your website with, I presume, daily updates?
Well, yeah, Arts and Letters Daily was started over 10 years ago. And at that time, I just had a feeling that there was more on that was appearing on the web by then than anybody could cope with. And I thought, why not have a single website where I simply chose what I consider to be personal quirks and whatnot, the best reading that's available on the web in one place, write some kind of amusing teaser to sort of get people interested in the article, and link to it. In other words, it's nothing but a page of links, a very simple idea. And I think it had 300 readers on the first day. I sent out some kind of, you know, emails, which was really actually spam, if you think about it. I mean, I don't know, a couple of hundred emails, but I had 300 readers on the first day. And I really never looked back. It has now 3.7 million page views per month. So in a sense, it's really the biggest website in the world, suppose, for intellectual reading of the kind that it offers. And I'm trying very hard every day there to present contrarian views. It's not simply good writing, although I very much like good writing. But I like to have a different view of what's going on in the world. For example, at the top of the page today, because we're recording this in the week of the 40th anniversary of the moon landing, I've got an article by a literary writer who's cursing Neil Armstrong because he says the Apollo moon landings thrust a knife into the heart of science fiction. The science fiction's never fully recovered, he thinks, from the moon landings. And, you know, that's a very interesting point. I hadn't thought of that until I read this piece. And I'm always looking for things that have a sort of an approach to an issue which I hadn't thought of, and I think other people hadn't thought of. I'm just looking for what's interesting and what's maybe advanced thinking that might take us into the future rather than just turning over the past.
From my perspective and limited experience, I would recommend to our listeners that they have a look at your website, artsandlettersdaily.com. Well, Dennis Dutton, author of The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution, I thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I have a couple of signature questions. The first being, can you tell us of an interesting idea or concept or eureka moment that's occurred to you lately?
Yes, I've been thinking a lot, and it has to do with a couple of books I've been reading, about recent human evolution. My book, The Art Instinct, takes the view and expresses the view as based on a quite standard view of evolution, and that is to say that evolution happened in the Pleistocene in the 1.6 million years, which is 80,000 generations, a huge period of time before the invention of cities and agriculture. That's the Holocene. That's 10,000 years ago, so that's just yesterday. Most people say and talk as though evolution happened in the Pleistocene, so at the beginning of the Pleistocene, you've got your ancestors. If you saw them on the street, you'd probably, you know, call the SPCA or the local zoo and try to get out there with tranquilizer guns. At the end of the Pleistocene, if you saw your ancestors, they'd be just like you and me. There'd be no difference. So we say that's where evolution happened, and then most people think that evolution stopped 10,000 years ago. One thing which I've been thinking a lot about is that now it's beginning to appear as though there's been significant human evolution in terms of mental evolution in the last 10,000 years, and that there's been differential evolution in different parts of the world. So you might find that Ashkenazi Jews are not quite the same in terms of how they develop up in Northern Europe as opposed to other different ethnic types around the world. And so that's an idea, and that's based actually in on the two books that I've been reading recently, which I've spent a lot of time with and gotten a lot of value from. One is called The 10,000-Year Explosion by Gregory Cochran and Henry Harpendine, and that's from Basic Books. The 10,000-Year Explosion is about changes in human evolution in the last 10,000 years, and it's also backed up by another fascinating book by Nicholas Wade, the New York Times writer, called Before the Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors. Before the Dawn by Nicholas Wade, and that's a terrific book. I recommend them both.
Well, we've visited with the authors of The 10,000-Year Explosion on Radio Curious. It's fascinating. I'm 66, and I grew up in Studio City. Did we cross paths earlier?
Oh, really? Did you go to Walter Reed Junior High School?
I did when it was North Hollywood Junior High School.
So we were there at the same time. I'll be damned, we were students.
Well, remember when we voted on the name of the school, changing it, either Walter Reed or Amelia Earhart? I voted for Amelia.
I think I did, too. You see, we have a lot in common.
Yeah.
Very delighted to hear from you. Gosh.
Well, Dennis Tutton, thank you again for being with us on Radio Curious.
And it was a delight to talk to you.
Dennis Dutton is a professor of philosophy of art at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand and the author of The Art Instinct, Beauty, Pleasure, and Human Evolution. I spoke with him from his home in Christchurch, New Zealand on July 17, 2009. The books Dennis Dutton recommends are Before the Dawn, Recovering the Lost History of Our Ancestors by Nicholas Wade, and The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution by Gregory Cochran and Henry Harpending. You can listen to a Radio Curious interview with Gregory Cochran on The 10,000-Year Explosion by visiting our website at www.radiocurious.org. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.